Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. This past weekend, Denver held its annual Hedonist People's Fair. This Friday night at 7 o'clock, just in 2 days from now, there's going to be a very special follow-up that perhaps you'll join me about. But one of our listeners and an indefatigable evangelist, Daniel Hedrick, went to the People's Fair last week. He's the founder of the GodIsNowHere.org ministry. And he went up to the atheist tent and then to the Christian tent run by the Old Earth Hugh Ross group, Reasons to Believe. And he asked the leader of both groups the same question about dinosaur research. And both groups gave the exact same answer. And then they gave the same answer to his follow-up question. So I'm going to tell you what they said, and then I'm going to go to an extraordinary scientist, and we'll see what he says. So he asked them this: when scientists research dinosaurs, do they research fossilized bone or actual bone or both? In both tents, the Christian, Old Earth Christians and the atheists, they both said fossilized bone, like bone that had turned to stone. And then he told them about dinosaur soft tissue. And he showed them the photos from science journals of dinosaur blood vessels and blood cells. And you know what both groups said, the atheists and the Old Earth Christians? They both said the exact same thing. Oh yeah, we heard of that. Well, if you heard about it, why didn't you answer the question correctly? They said, we heard about it, except it was an anomaly. And they said it was a unique discovery, a peculiar anomaly that we'll figure out. So right here now, let's go to Dr. Kevin Anderson. He's the director of the Van Andel Research Center in Chino Valley, Arizona. Dr. Anderson, welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
And you're going to be speaking Friday night, June 10th. 2016 at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship on this very topic on your iDino project.
That is correct. Yes, certainly will.
So do you think, Dr. Anderson, that and you have a PhD in molecular biology and you're one of the published authors, it's quite an elite group of scientists who have published in prominent scientific journals the discovery of dinosaur soft tissue. Do you think they're right that it's an anomaly and it's just a single rare discovery that's unique around the world?
Well, I would find that comment interesting, since a year ago in a paper in the journal Nature Communications, which is hardly a creation-friendly journal.
No.
He'd emphasize that. Yeah. In that paper, they just matter-of-factly stated that the preservation and discovery of this tissue in dinosaur fossils is common. In other words, they were suggesting we would expect to find it in almost all dinosaur fossils that are examined.
It's common.
That certainly isn't an anomaly. The anomaly would be not finding it.
Yeah, in that particular study, the British Museum, they took out, or was there a Museum of Nature and Science, they took 8 dinosaur bones from their inventory in their basement, and they had been sitting in a drawer for over 100 years from different dinosaurs, and they said, well, people are finding soft tissue. They looked, and lo and behold, thousands, perhaps millions, of blood cells in 6 out of the 8 bones, blood cells and other soft tissue. So that sounds like it's not an anomaly.
Exactly. That's why they called it common. I mean, that was also then in the face of all the other illustrations that have been found over the years. And of course, then last fall was a wonderful, wonderful study done by Mary Schweitzer and collaborators where they extracted blood vessels from some dinosaur fossils so that you know it's not contamination. It's not something that is inadvertently there. It's actual blood vessels from the bones. And then they extracted proteins from those blood vessels, and lo and behold, they found the whole panorama of proteins you would expect to find in the blood vessels of a vertebrate animal. So very consistent with what you would expect, and I would say absolutely confirms that this is dinosaur tissue, it is dinosaur proteins,
yes.
It's not anomalies, it is common,
right.
And it's even almost considered routine now. So to take the position they're taking, what that tells you is we don't want to talk about it, we don't want to think about it. They're like the monkeys, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. We just simply don't want to deal with it because it's too hard for us to deal with.
Right. Three quick things. If somebody Googles dinosaur soft tissue, they'll find our website right near the top, kgov.com, and we list all the peer-reviewed studies. We list them all. They're right there, so you can check them out. Secondly, we say this. You'll find dinosaur soft tissue when you look for it. When you go look for it, that's when you find it. And thirdly, the paper you referenced, Mary Schweitzer, she was the first to publish in a leading journal, powerful argument that, look, this is actual dinosaur soft tissue. So that paper you're referencing was the first time they dropped the word apparent. They stopped saying apparent dinosaur blood vessels, apparent red blood cells, and now they're just saying, look, this has been confirmed. This is actual soft tissue that grew in the dinosaur.
Yes, yes, exactly. So, it is now considered just standard operation, standard discovery, just like you would expect to discover, you know, silica in a fossil, you now expect to find tissue in these fossils also.
Mm.
So it's just now considered part of the fossil. The irony is what that really means is the fossil is not fully fossilized. It is a fossil, but it's not yet, because fossils go through stages. You don't go immediately overnight from a bone to a fossil. It takes time. Mm. And obviously it hasn't been enough time yet, and yet I think no one would argue that 65 million years isn't enough time.
Right.
So,
65 million and 80 million and 150
yeah.
million,
yeah.
and they go all the way up to hundreds of millions of years.
Well,
various.
Right, because then you get in even beyond, before the dinosaurs, by evolution time scale,
right.
you get into sponges and beardworms, for example, and they've pulled proteins out of these, and these are Cambrian animals.
Yes.
By their time scale, 500 million years old, and still got protein in them.
Right.
You know, now we're getting to the point where rationality isn't even being applied anymore. It's just
right.
the paradigm of old age wins regardless of the data. We're not going to consider that this data suggests these fossils aren't as old as we claim them to be. It just means there's got to be something else going on. And so the paradigm of the old Earth, the paradigm of millions of years, always wins. Everything else must bow to it.
Mm. You mentioned some of these, like in crinoids, they say they're 350 million years old and they've got soft tissue. Precambrian metoans, I don't even know how to pronounce it. this is in the Journal of Paleontology in 2014. They said this is 530 million years
yes.
old.
Yes.
And chitin and chitin-associated proteins.
Right.
This is in
right.
the Journal of Geology 2011. They said it was 417 million years old, soft tissue. And the stuff, the way we say it here on Real Science Radio, is it's not dissimilar to what you would find in Egyptian mummy bones, because although they're mostly dried out and decomposed, you do find remnants of proteins.
The irony is, one of the differences that preservation of the mummies is by desiccation. Preservation of the dinosaur proteins and the sponge proteins is not by desiccation. They're actually wet. Certainly many of these bones, when they pull them out of the ground, they still have a soft, moist material inside. So they're not dried out. They're not dehydrated. So it's actually
what
a completely different preservation process. In fact, it's a better preservation process because they would recognize we wouldn't expect to find DNA, for example, in a mummy because DNA will dehydrate and decompose. But we do have evidence that they're finding DNA in these dinosaur fossils.
Yes, specifically in Hadrosaur and T-Rex. They've done multiple tests for a double helix. And not just randomly somewhere in this dinosaur bone, but they look in the bone cells, the osteocytes.
Correct.
Which are immaculately preserved. And inside the bone cell, they see the nucleus. And so inside the nucleus, they run these tests for double helix, and they get positive results.
Correct. There's a specific stain called DAPI that will bind to the groove of a double helical strand of DNA. And while they have not yet been able, at least reported, been able to extract enough DNA to actually do DNA sequence, the simple fact that this DAPI binds to something indicates you have at least a strand of DNA that's 20 to 22 bases in length, because that's what it would take to, in order to get this binding site for the DAPI stain. So, yeah, we have very good chemical indication that there is DNA still in these cells.
So before I ask you more about that, let's tell folks about Friday night, June 10th, 2016, because I'm just so thrilled that you are here in Colorado and you'll be speaking at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. That's in Southeast Denver. It's on Yale Ave, just off of I-25 in Yale. You head east just a few blocks. It's 5900 East Yale Ave. And Dr. Anderson, you're a molecular biologist, but you're going to be talking about dinosaurs.
I'm going to be talking about dinosaurs, yeah. Some people have jokingly called me kind of an avocational paleontologist. Yeah, I had no idea years ago I'd be actually out in the field digging dinosaur fossils, but well, I've done it several times now.
Well, it doesn't make sense, right? Because a molecular biologist would not be studying stones, rock.
Correct.
It's called permineralized fossils when the bone turns to stone. But some years ago, when we started creating our dinosaur soft tissue list for Real Science Radio, what we were highlighting is that at Harvard and universities around the world, the molecular biologist had teamed up with the paleontologist to publish these papers in the world's leading science journals.
Yes.
And so if it's molecular biologist, and this is for a period of years when atheists around the world, including famous atheists, were denying that there was any discovery of dinosaur soft tissue.
Right. When it was first, well, in fact, there was actually reports of potential discoveries of the data all the way back to the 60s, which, of course, were just for the most part ignored because no one wanted to deal with it, and it was easier to ignore than to try to explain how it was there.
Yeah.
And then, as you mentioned, Mary Schweitzer's 2005 paper was done well enough and presented color pictures, and that's the key, I think, color pictures. They couldn't ignore it very much. They couldn't ignore it too well any longer, so they had to start addressing it. So the initial approach was just simply to dismiss it as, well, it's some kind of, you know, bacterial biofilm, it's some kind of contamination, it's just some kind of bizarre something, we don't know what it is. But we've moved, you know, it's now 2016, and that's not an acceptable answer anymore. It is dinosaur. And so now anybody that says that it's not dinosaur just simply doesn't know the literature, simply is not keeping up. And I've run into graduate students and professors that, I heard that Dr. Schweitzer, you know, retracted that discovery. I heard that it was proven to be something. See, anything but the truth is what it comes down to.
Well,
they just simply don't want to know the truth because that's too hard to deal with.
Dr. Anderson, I'm looking at our list. We call it the STDs, the soft tissue deniers, at our website.
Yeah.
It's kgov.com/STDs. And we have Oxford-educated, widely published anti-creationists like Paul Braderman. On March 8, 2014, he wrote, "Despite much hype, the only surviving material is a collagen bone composite." I mean, they're just making this stuff up.
They're just making it up.
Smithsonian.
Right. They're not even pretending very well to be scientific. But regrettably, in this fallen world, that's acceptable. As long as it's not the truth, it's acceptable to just make it up. It's acceptable to just ignore what is known, ignore what's discovered. Yeah.
Well,
that ought to be incredible embarrassment to them.
Yes.
But they won't be embarrassed because it just serves their agenda.
Well, out of our list of so many examples, I'll leave out phys.org and Talk Origins, and others. And I'll just mention Smithsonian dinosaur expert Brian Switek, S-W-I-T-E-K. In 2012, late 2012, he wrote that the dinosaur soft tissue may be just bacteria. Now, that was absurd. By 2012, there were so many peer-reviewed papers.
Yes.
They had sequenced proteins from dinosaurs.
Exactly.
And they're doing this at universities around the world. So then, in 2014, he created his list of the top 10 dinosaur mysteries. And then as late as 2015, he guess what he left off his list? Dinosaur soft tissue. He shows an extraordinary lack of interest in the greatest paleontological discovery in history, that dinosaur tissue is extant. It's everywhere.
Yeah, he just doesn't want to deal with it. That's ignoring is always one strategy of not dealing with something.
So could you tell us a bit, maybe a little bit about the soft tissue Triceratops horn that you found and co-authored a paper in Acta Histochemica, and then maybe a little glimpse about your presentation?
In 2012, the Croatian Research Society sent a team to the Glendive area in Montana, which is a very popular area for digging dinosaur fossils, and we were able to excavate a Triceratops horn. Now, this horn was massive. It was almost 4 feet in length and almost 10 inches in diameter. I mean, it was probably the single biggest Triceratops horn that had been excavated in that region of Montana.
Wow.
So, of course, the museum people were just beside themselves that our primary objective was to break it up rather than preserve it for museum people.
Right, of course.
But it was taken in and examined then, and tissue was found, cells were found. We really had some wonderful extractions we were able to get from the horn. And one of the ironies is that water will quickly decay tissue. I mean, water is an excellent hydrolytic mechanism to break down proteins, to break down other molecules that keep tissue intact. And so one of the arguments that evolution has posed is, well, for these fossils to preserve the tissue, they have to be dry. The problem is there's no such thing really as a dry place in sandstone, in these rocks, because groundwater percolates all over, and this horn was not buried very deeply, and it was damp when we pulled it out of the ground, because obviously rainwater intercalated down. So it was certainly anything but dry. And even at that time, I thought, I was just thinking the horn was just a few thousand years old and was thinking, we're not going to find anything even then, let alone the horn being, 68 million years old.
Right.
And yet, sure enough, we did. So the preservation condition of the horn was anything but what would be necessary to preserve this tissue for all these tens of millions of years. And yet there it was, very obvious. We found lots of tissue.
Yeah.
So, right, I'll be presenting quite a bit of this, showing pictures of what we found, pictures of the horn itself, just discussing some of the explanations that evolutionists have attempted to come up with. I call them the fig leaves. They're just trying to cover something, trying to protect their position, saying that the fossils are millions of years old, when this is very strong evidence that they're not millions of years old, and just show some of the weaknesses of some of their explanations, why they don't work.
Well,
and so, right, we're going to go into some pretty good detail on some of this.
Dr. Anderson, probably 80%, 90% of our audience is beyond the Denver metro area. So for folks who can't make it, let me encourage them to go to our website, kgov.com/triceratops. And there is a photo from CRS, a CRS photo of some of the cells from this Triceratops horn. It's absolutely extraordinary. And for those who could make it this Friday night at 7 o'clock, to be able to hear, and there should be a Q&A period, I believe, after your talk, to be able to interact with one of the scientists who have published in a peer-reviewed science journal of the discovery of dinosaur soft tissue. This is actually historic, and it is the greatest paleontological discovery in history, the fact that we have found dinosaur soft tissue, and yet the mainstream media has almost completely ignored it because I think they intuitively know that if they lose the dinosaurs, they lose it all.
Yes.
If they lose the dinosaurs, they lose it all because they've invested everything in claiming these are 80 million years old. And when anybody could look at this soft, pliable, transparent blood vessel and you squeeze it and blood cells come out and say, that's young. Dinosaurs were young.
Yes, absolutely. I'll also put in a shameless plug
for
my own book. I just finished a month ago a book called Echoes of the Jurassic. And it's a small book. It's only 56 pages. It's written to be a quick read. It's written to be reasonably easy to read, but it's also written to give anybody interested in this topic, which should be everybody, a source that they can go to with all the documentation, with everything, you know, all the references and everything, and just hopefully a description and an explanation material they can, you know, hand to someone else to get them to read it. The book's only $6, so it's intended to be a fairly inexpensive source of information, and people buy the book, hand it to friends, and tell them to read it, and really just get people, as you've been talking about, get people exposed to this, because they're not hearing about it from the general press.
Right, and certainly not from the public schools, and not even in college.
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine was talking with a paleontology graduate student. Here's a graduate student in paleontology, and she'd never heard of it.
Right.
Yeah, again, it's just denial is their primary way of dealing with it, because to deal with it on the actual science, it's very difficult, very tough.
I'm sure that Real Science Radio and CRS, your organization that you're on the board of, Creation Research Society, between us, we have told more people about dinosaur soft tissue than NBC, Fox News, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and the LA Times combined.
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
The only thing is CBS did a 60 Minutes special way back 2005 or so. And other than that, it's been very quiet.
And Dr. Anderson, they buried it 40 minutes into a one-hour program.
Yeah. But they haven't. You've not heard anything from them since. There's been no follow-up. There's been no let's keep up with this story. Yeah, they did one episode, and that's it.
Well, perhaps we could change topics, because it's not every day we have a molecular biologist on the show. And I think in your background, you know a bit about our immune system. And here on Real Science Radio, we have been highlighting the astounding results, really the revolution in cancer treatment coming from targeted antibodies. Dr. Anderson, the progress that's being made, one study, advanced leukemia patients, stage 3 and 4, 35 patients, 33 were essentially cured. A lung cancer patient in Britain, a major report that he was one of a number in a study who recovered. He was in hospice, given 2 weeks left to live when they gave him targeted antibodies. He has fully recovered. He's back home for months now. He said he feels perfectly normal. So what does it mean to have targeted antibodies? Are you familiar with that?
Yes. Let me give you hopefully you and your listeners, just a teeny bit of background. One of the ironies of this type of cancer approach is that at least some of the basics of this could have been done back in the 60s. Mm. But at that time, I can't document this, but it's certainly the sense I get just talking with other scientists and just having an understanding of the general thinking. The idea was that obviously when you've developed cancer, the immune system is defeated. Obviously, the immune system is weak. It just can't handle the job. In fact, there's been a lot of arguments, and I'm sure you've dealt with some of them, just poor design. You know, the body is just not very well designed. It's got all these problems with it and such. And so by the time you came to the late 60s and early 70s, and then President Richard Nixon threw a lot of money into cancer, the idea was, well, we're going to have to come up with some high-techy, some very sophisticated approach to fighting cancer, because obviously the poor design of the immune system just isn't capable of doing it.
So what did they do? They used radiation.
They used radiation. They used chemotherapeutic drugs and such. And what they found was that over the course of the next three decades, you had a certain recovery rate, and that was it. It plateaued. And for the most part, a few years ago, there was a very indicting paper that came out doing the statistics and showing that, by and large, with the only a few exceptions, you were no more likely to survive cancer in, you know, the 21st century than you were in the 1970s. They just hadn't made any strides.
Wow.
And that was kind of a wake-up call. And so then some researchers began to go back to the 1960s, if you will, and began to look then at the immune system. Since the 1960s, our understanding of the immune system has grown immensely. And we now recognize, instead of the immune system being this kind of poorly designed, easily defeated system, it is so intricate and so marvelous that we are still struggling to understand even some of the basics of it. I can't emphasize enough how sophisticated the human immune system is.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Instead of being weak, what we find is the immune system, and mark this, the immune system cannot be defeated. The only thing that happens is the immune system has breaks, because it'd be like if you're trying to find a single terrorist in a building in New York and you bring in an atomic bomb. Mm. What happens? You get the terrorists, but you get the whole New York too,
right,
and you don't accomplish
right.
much. The right. immune system can wipe out all cancer in your body. The problem is it'd take you along with it, and
right.
you'd be cancer-free laying in the morgue.
Right.
And the same with any kind of virus or any kind of bacteria. It will wipe them out, but it would likely wipe you out at the same time. So the immune system has breaks. And the question is, how can we then, with our human God-given intelligence, be able to somehow get around or adjust those breaks? Mm. And when we do some of what you're talking about, then that allows the immune system to kick in a very controlled manner, and then we see the true power of the immune system come into play, and the cancer cells don't have a chance.
Oh, this is thrilling beyond measure. I mean, there are oncologists who are going public saying, we don't say the word extraordinary in our field, but these results are extraordinary.
They are extraordinary, right.
They say, we don't say the word cure in our field, but this looks like a cure. And, of course, there's 1,000 different kinds of cancers, and you got to target each one individually.
Yes.
But that's happened. I mean,
that's where the antibodies come in. And an antibody is a protein that's made by what's called a B cell. That's one of your immune cells that's constantly in your blood system. And that in itself is a complicated process, how that B cell knows what to make as far as the antibody, because the antibody is going to have a specific binding capability. It's going to bind to a very particular location, a very particular molecule.
Mm.
And how the B cell knows how to do that itself is almost mind-boggling.
Wow. Dr. Anderson, Kevin Anderson with Creation Research Society and the author of Echoes of the Jurassic. We're out of time, Dr. Anderson, but this Friday night at 7 o'clock, Lord willing, I'll be there with, in fact, the man I mentioned at the intro, Daniel Hedrick, founder of GodIsNowHere.org ministry, will be there together. We're encouraging others to come on out. And if you can't get there to get the book, Echoes of the Jurassic, how about your wonderful wife, Diane? Is she in town?
She will be with me. Yes, she will.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Kevin. Can't wait to see you in just
Thank
a
you.
Few hours.
All right.
God bless you. That's Kevin Anderson. What a thrill to talk to him. You know, tonight after the presentation, I'm going to ask him, how do they do the targeting? How do they actually target an antibody to a cancer cell or to a tumor? That'll be fun. Hey, God bless you guys. For Fred Williams and Real Science Radio.